The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Chris Cutrone is a college educator, writer, and media artist. He's committed to critical thinking and artistic practice and to the politics of social emancipation. He is the former head of the often contrarian Marxist group, the Platypus Affiliated Society, and in this podcast, we discuss the idea of realizing philosophy. It's Sunday, October 6, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is available in full for everyone, but our patrons usually get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. They also get access to our History of Communism video series, interviews with authors for our monthly book club, and pretty soon, a reprised series called Pop the Left. If you're a fan of this podcast, consider becoming a patron. The music you're listening to right now is entitled The Cuban Guys and is available through the Storyblocks website. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Chris Cutrone and I discuss how to realize philosophy.
In that Ends of Philosophy essay that I wrote last year, I wrote it for a Platypus event that was kind of an internal event, a sort of atypical Platypus event, an internal event, a discussion on philosophy among our members. And the occasion for it was Karl Korsch's essay on Marxism and philosophy from 1923. And the end of that essay has the statement that philosophy can only be abolished by being realized. And, of course, this is something taken up by Adorno in Negative Dialectics. In the beginning of Negative Dialectics, Adorno says that philosophy has lived on because its moment for realization was missed.
So when did he think...
So that's
when did,
my...
When did Adorno think that moment was? Or did he pinpoint a moment, do you think?
1917, 1918, 1919.
Okay.
I mean, alternatively, 1848.
Yeah, I was going to say, not 1848, but...
No, it would have been 1848. I mean, that is actually Korsch's thesis. Korsch's thesis is that he calls it a curious gap or blank spot in the history of philosophy in the mid-19th century, in the aftermath of the disintegration of Hegelianism. And then philosophy makes a comeback in the late 19th century. Now, of course, this is a kind of a rough and ready history that Korsch is providing that neglects Kierkegaard, for example, who's kind of a contemporary.
I'm okay with neglecting Kierkegaard, but go ahead.
Well, the point, I think that Korsch, like Lukács, is in a sense preoccupied by the phenomenon of neo-Kantianism at the end of the 19th century. In other words, that philosophy seems to make a comeback as if the crisis of Hegelianism had never existed, also as if Marxism didn't exist.
Well, not to get into esoteria, but I thought for a while that we are still mostly Kantians today, that like the analytic tradition and the continental tradition are two sides of Kant. We can talk about what that would mean, but I don't think that's wrong. But it seems to me a little strange to think that we could have had 1848, maybe because I want to privilege philosophy here, that the 1848 revolution could have worked and succeeded to realizing Hegelianism, say, before Marx wrote Capital, you know, before Marx completed his intellectual project, that it seems like there has to be an intellectual side to the development and realization of philosophy.
Oh, you mean because he hadn't written his Das Kapital? Well, this is of course something that Kautsky criticized the Bolsheviks and criticized what he calls the theorists of communism. So he included Luxembourg as well as Lenin and Trotsky in this. He was writing in response to Korsch, and he wrote a criticism of Korsch's Marxism and Philosophy, in which he said that the theorists of communism neglect the later Marx, the mature Marx, in favor of the Marx of the 1840s.
Right. And where do you land on that?
I don't think that there's a contradiction between the two. In other words, I think that that's a kind of on Kautsky's part, a kind of a bullshit critique, meaning I don't see Das Kapital as a new discovery or a change for Marx, but rather as a fulfillment, as a further elaboration of his concerns going back to the 1840s.
Okay, but even if that's the case, don't we have to have that sort of intellectual fulfillment before we can realize ideas? I mean, just to be really simple-minded about it, don't we have to understand the difference between sensuous useful labor and abstract labor in order to change the mode of production? Don't we have to understand capital as it was an embryo in, say, Smith's time and as it is in Marx's time and in our time in order to not just take the factories, but truly transform and expropriate the capitalists and capital?
Yes, to properly recognize the problem. I mean, it's an interesting, there's actually a phenomenon by which one can grasp this, which is to say Ferdinand LaSalle, who was a devotee, a follower of Marx, circa 1848, who subsequently broke with Marx. Marx ended up breaking with everyone. But anyway, the critique of the Goethe program by Marx, a critique of LaSallianism and even of residual or undigested LaSallianism among Marx's own followers, could be seen as a kind of a late Marx critique of his earlier self, of whom LaSalle had been a follower. Like, you could try to grasp it that way, specifically in the way that you're discussing it, namely that labor is more specified as labor power, and the contradiction of labor power being in its measure in labor time, right? That the further kind of specification of the problem of capitalism, that would appear to be necessary in order to overcome a kind of bourgeois set of assumptions about political economy that might have still been running for Marx in the 1840s. What I would say is that Marx is already aware of a self-contradiction in bourgeois political economy in the 1840s. And I think I make reference in my Ends of Philosophy, but without getting into the political economy of it, of Marx's critique of Proudhon in the Philosophy of Misery. And so what's interesting is that if you read the Proudhon, if you don't only read Marx's critique, which Marx's critique is, as usual, somewhat tendentious, and really Marx just uses it as an excuse to elaborate his own ideas in The Poverty of Philosophy. But if you read the actual Proudhon, most Marxists would be hard-pressed to say how Proudhon isn't already Marxist. In other words, Proudhon distinguishes between Smith and industrial capitalism. He gets into the whole cooperation, manufacture, industry, business, and even the problem of labor time. In other words, that Proudhon has a critique of the reification of labor time by people like David Ricardo. So that's already there, and of course, since Marx is using that as his object of critique, of course, then he's aware of it. Proudhon is already aware of it. And so, of course, Marx is already aware of it.
So you're saying that he's sort of unfair to Proudhon, that Proudhon's understanding of how labor time or the pursuit of labor time or the expansion of labor time and as a value determines a lot of our social relations. Do you think Proudhon has worked that out adequately or in his work?
I would say no, that Marx is not unfair and Proudhon had not adequately worked it out, but at least the problem is registered. Now, in terms of what working it out means, what working it out means is, of course, fully elaborating the contradiction. And what we find with Marx, the early Marx, the 1840s Marx, is that he already has a critique of socialism, he already has a critique of communism, he has a critique of the demand for abolishing private property, and he has a critique of Proudhon, who is he considers to be the most advanced sort of socialist of his time. And yet, right, the idea being that Marx thinks that there's a kind of naivete. For instance, Proudhon has a kind of a labor time voucher idea, right? And so it's, you know, Marx has a critique of that as inadequate, but that doesn't mean that he would oppose it necessarily as a political demand, right? In other words, the political demand is only problematic insofar as it doesn't recognize itself as an extension of capitalism and naively considers itself to be simply anti-capitalism.
Right. I mean, this is something that I've been wrestling with for a while. I mean, I've been pretty convinced by the state capitalist critique of the Soviet Union. And people will direct me to the critique of the Gotha program, some lines that I read many times but sort of refused to, you know, fully take on in the critique of the Gotha program. And it's only recently that I came to realize a couple of things about what Marx is suggesting there. The main thing that he's suggesting there is that you set up a system where capitalism is functioning sort of as it wants to. That you're really having an exchange of labor time for commodities and right, explicitly. And the reason for that is not because that's the ultimate system or that's how things should be or that's fair. In fact, it's precisely the opposite, because it's not fair. It's because it will bring forward the kind of the ludicrous aspect of this pursuit of labor time. And so you have this, he says that the system of commodity production won't be at loggerheads with itself. It will be laid bare, and people will understand that when you're exchanging 1 hour for 1 hour's worth of commodities, that there's nothing just about that, because there is no such thing as 1 hour's worth of commodities. In fact, there's people produce at different rates and have different abilities and so forth. And that the whole point of that is not to create a just system. That's not communism or something. That's just a way towards, I mean, it's almost like he's doing a psychological critique. It's almost like he's like saying, let's expose the symptom. And
by realizing it.
By realizing
it. In other words, yeah. let's fulfill this demand and people will be confronted with the self-contradictory character of the demand.
Right.
In practice.
I mean, whether or not that would actually work in practice is
who knows,
right?
Who knows,
right? But that's the idea there, and so that was to understand that finally was very revealing.
No, I think this is very important, in fact, because Marx doesn't have an alternative program to pre-Marxian or non-Marxian or even anti-Marxian socialism. What he has is a self-consciousness of it as expressing contradiction. Meaning socialism and communism are the highest expressions of capitalist contradiction.
Well, so I want to step back, because I feel like we just dived.
Yes.
We dove in.
We went into political economy, right?
Right, which is where I always like to go. But it's also sort of rarefied, maybe. And also, it doesn't really set up the philosophical point here. And so what I want to ask is this. Why did Marx consider philosophy to be ideological? Like, is his critique of ancient philosophy, maybe the Greeks, to be seen through his critique of the young Hegelians or through his book, The German Ideology? Or is he saying something else about philosophy in general?
I mean, we could say that Marx and Engels started out with a critique of young Hegelianism and moved from the critique of young Hegelianism and of left Hegelianism in particular, moved from that to the critique of political economy. In other words, that they moved from idealism to materialism. However, I don't think that that's accurate. In other words, I think that they are the same thing. In other words, the critique of bourgeois philosophy in its disintegration is actually the same thing as the critique of bourgeois political economy in its disintegration.
Can you spell that out a little bit? Can you unpack that a little?
Okay, so, you know, if we recall that the young Hegelians thought of themselves as socialists or communists, Moses Hess or Feuerbach or Bruno Bauer, right? And so now, in other words, the usual way of thinking about this is that Marx is trying to expose the idealism by showing its material base or something like that. But Feuerbach had already kind of made that move, right? And the critique of Feuerbach is that you can't oppose the material to the ideal because, after all, how does that consciousness come into being? In other words, you can't set up a kind of materialist education about ideal categories because who's going to educate the educator? Right? Like the theses on Feuerbach. And so most people just go directly to the final thesis on Feuerbach about interpreting the world versus changing it. But actually, the more substantial points are in the earlier theses, for instance, on who's going to educate the educator. And so in this respect, what Marx is trying to do, he's playing off the philosophical manifestation of the crisis of bourgeois society against the political economic manifestation of the crisis of bourgeois society, namely the proletarianized working classes' demands for the value of their labor. And so it's, you know, obviously the dominant ideological expression was the political economic demands of the working class. In other words, the discontents in philosophy are a relatively minor subset of the crisis of bourgeois society, right? It's a more rarefied object. But as he says in, you know, the letter to Ruge for the ruthless critique of everything existing, he says, we could begin anywhere. We could begin with any of the forms of this society and expose the totality of the self-contradiction of the society via any of its forms. So we could proceed with religion. We could proceed with philosophy. We could proceed with political economy. We could take any form and proceed in the imminent dialectical critique of that form. Now, I think that for political strategic reasons, Marx and Engels come to prioritize the critique of political economy. But they never abandon the critique of philosophy.
Yeah, well, so my understanding here, if I'm following you, there's a piece here that I think I'm missing, which is the precise way, and maybe this is what the Frankfurt School was working on, the precise way in which the problems that are arising materially, say, for the working class and that set up their demands, how those then get transformed into philosophical problems. Like, what is the mechanism by which this transformation takes place? I mean, if the nice thing about the critique of the political economy is that, you know, at least there's a feeling as though that is worked out the way that, say, productive activity is transformed into value, social value. That's worked out. But I don't see a way in which these demands for bread are becoming questions of subjectivity versus objectivity. Not directly.
Okay, right. So, I mean, if we take Hegel as the highest expression of bourgeois philosophy, Now, of course, there's the question of what bourgeois philosophy is, and this would get to the distinction that I think is important in terms of the series that you're envisioning on realizing philosophy. The distinction of bourgeois philosophy from ancient philosophy. Even though Hegel takes up ancient philosophy in his self-consciously modern bourgeois philosophy, still there's a transformation, and that transformation, it hinges on freedom, hinges on the question of freedom. And you could say that even ancient philosophy is concerned with human self-determination, human agency, human autonomy, but still Hegel thinks that it's only in bourgeois society that we've actually arrived at the true substance and content of that autonomy and that freedom. Meaning, Aristotle might angle in that direction, Plato might angle in that direction, but they haven't really grasped the substance of it. And the substance, of course, for Hegel, you know, in terms of the word made flesh, is in fact labor. It is, in fact, the cooperative society of the exchange of labor. You know, it is the Rousseauian general will. It's the community that is more than the sum of its parts, that transcends the individual interest, even if against the individual will or behind the backs of the actors. You know, Rousseau talks about this, Kant talks about this, Smith talks about this. And indeed, it has its roots earlier in Locke and others. And so in that respect, when Hegel says that now all are free, all humans are free as humans, what he means is that it's in bourgeois society that we can recognize and grasp and also advance in practice the actual participation of all humans in the community, in the self-determination of humanity, in a way that was not recognized and was perhaps unrecognizable to the ancients.
Right. I mean, Socrates starts out by asking, you know, what is justice? What is piety? He doesn't start out by asking what is freedom. And the way that I think of this is that, you know, Hegel comes along to answer Socrates however many years later by saying, well, justice is only to be achieved and understood through a process towards freedom. And I mean, that's put it that way, put it so simply, it's too abstract, doesn't mean anything, but I feel as though that resonates at least with me, but,
I think it means something. You know, in other words, like the bourgeois emancipation of labor, right? So the revolt of the third estate, the revolt of the laboring classes, as opposed to the non-laboring classes, meaning the clergy and the aristocracy, the emancipation of labor is profound, right? That's a profound historical transformation, meaning that rather than following the dictates of God and also the more or less mystical understandings of guild craft activity. In other words, that, you know, the stonemasons think that they are indoctrinated, initiated into the mysteries of stone and its special principles, right? Like that's, and that you're preserving this knowledge from ancient Egypt when you become a stonemason, right? That is overthrown in bourgeois emancipation, in which labor is autonomous in the sense that it is free to transform itself in a limitless and endless way.
Forgive my pop culture reference, but have you ever watched the television show Community?
Oh, only a couple of episodes. I haven't followed it, no. But yeah.
Well, one episode, one of the characters is found to be kind of naturally skilled at repairing things, and the workman at the community college pulls him aside to try to indoctrinate him into the secret society of air conditioner repairmen.
Absolutely.
Done. Mr. Barnes, walk with me. Mr. Barnes, air conditioning repairs an elite worldwide family dating back to the very beginnings of civilizations. Our predecessors were slaves, fanning the pharaohs with palm fronds. Over time, we became expert at making our superiors comfortable. We made it our business. And along the way, we learned to make ourselves comfortable. No more palm fronds, Troy. Now we are the pharaohs.
Breath print approved.
Feel that?
Actually, I don't feel...
Precisely. Have you heard the expression room temperature?
Of course.
This is the room. This is the room temperature room.
I can't tell where the air ends and my skin begins. It's incredible.
That's what we do, Troy. Incredible, invisible, unbelievable things. We're an unseen, unknown, invincible fraternity of craftsmen. Graduates of this school are guaranteed lucrative employment for their entire lives. And I'm inviting you to join us.
Will there always be paninis?
There is one catch, Troy. Once you're in, you're in. Air conditioning repair will be your life. A life of secrets you'll be unable to share with outsiders. You will be an air conditioning repairman and nothing else until the day you die.
That's exactly what traditional civilization was, exactly. Is that a peasant child would be bought or, you know, taken by the guild if they were seen to have some natural propensity.
Right. He ends up rejecting that for just pursuing his education instead. He doesn't know what it wants to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think that Hegel is actually quite self-conscious about this. In other words, Hegel's a good reader of Adam Smith. He's obviously a good reader of Rousseau. And, you know, Kant is also a good reader of Rousseau and of Adam Smith, by the way. And they do understand human freedom as collective productive activity in which there's a dialectic of the individual and the collective. Meaning all of that is there, right? That idea of, the individual transcending himself through social cooperation. And again, this has turned into a transhistorical principle. It's turned into, this is what society has always aimed at, but it hadn't recognized it yet. Right. So it's a bourgeois narrative of progress in production.
Right. But the aim of production is to liberate both individuals and the totality of society to reach beyond itself.
It's to fulfill the potentialities of humanity.
But just to go back to philosophy a bit more, when I start to feel like I'm understanding this and it's easy, I start to get a little concerned. So I want to go back to this idea of like Marx's critique of the young Hegelians, because the way I understand it is that he is saying that they are too focused on the ideas in people's heads, or they feel as though just by changing people's ideas or their attitudes that they can change society, as if there are already these totally liberated individuals who can put their ideas into action directly and aren't mediated by the force of labor and the forms that society is already taking. So to me, that's also the critique that he might have of philosophy in general, is that it emphasizes ideas, like in a Platonic sense, maybe like of justice or of even of being, and And to say that actually has a deep resonance. I mean, it does tend to, if you say, oh yeah, even our understanding of being is mediated through our productive activity. I think a lot of people in the natural sciences will look at you funny.
Well, because society is a difficult object. In other words, to say that it's socially mediated, at one level, it's sort of, well, obviously true. At another level, what that exactly means is unclear.
Yeah. I saw you give a lecture after I read your piece. I also watched your presentation at the Platypus Affiliated Society meeting because it's on YouTube. And I think during the debate, there was a lot of questions going back and forth about whether or not the aim of Marx is scientific, or what is it a critique of science? How do natural sciences relate to Marx's project? The way that science, I guess, is conceived is sort of as a positivist, descriptive exploration of the world as it is almost empirically and apart from society. It's not a social relationship between each other. It's the way the world is out as we encounter it.
Well, let me say something. Let me back up a second and address the point about Marx's critique of the young Hegelians. So his critique of the young Hegelians is actually that they're falling below the threshold of Hegel, that even Hegel didn't think that social change was idea-driven, right? That Hegel thought that the idea comes after the change, right? The owl of Minerva flies at dusk. And so he treats the young Hegelians as revolutionaries, as, at the very least, reformers, who are kind of impatient with their German situation. Right, so that's why the German Ideology book that Marx and Engels wrote, which they then didn't publish, right? So they chose not to publish it, meaning that they had their own misgivings about proceeding in just this way. In other words, proceeding to critique the inadequacies of revolutionary ideology through philosophy. But that's what they're doing there. In other words, they are saying... And so there are two kind of problems that I want to sort of delineate. One is how change happened in terms of bourgeois emancipation, and the other in terms of how change might happen getting beyond capitalism, because they're not the same thing, right? So Hegel has his Owl of Minerva coming at dusk, and in other words, that we only know post festum what we've done, right? And Marx thinks that that's true. In other words, you could just sort of take that as axiomatic, but that in fact, that presents a problem when thinking of going beyond capitalism, right? And the problem there is it is the left versus right Hegelianism. In other words, the critique that he has of the left Hegelians is that they've become idealist in the bad sense, that they think that being revolutionary means having the right ideas. And he also, of course, because he is a left Hegelian, of course he has a critique of the right Hegelians. And right Hegelianism is conservative affirmative, meaning right Hegelianism just says, well, since the world is as it is, it must necessarily have come to be the way it is. And our task is only to recognize the rationality in the way the world is.
In other words, this is the best of all possible worlds.
Yes, or that this is the adequate expression of freedom. Right? The way the world actually is the stage of freedom that we've arrived at. And therefore, to reject it would be irrational.
And you can see someone who thinks that way today in Fukuyama.
Yes, absolutely. Fukuyama is a classic expression of this. But it's really there. It's also in Stalinism, which is to say freedom is the fulfillment of necessity, right? There's a kind of a collapse into right Hegelianism in Marxism itself. And Bernstein has that, you know, like a kind of revisionism has that kind of idea, which is that, you know, we are evolving socialism out of capitalism adequately. In other words, the current state of the workers' movement, its struggles within capitalism, is the horizon of socialism. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you still think you're evolving, this is a problem. If you still think you're evolving, that itself means that where you're at isn't adequate, right?
This is where the issue of regression that Platypus emphasizes so much comes in. In other words, the idea that in capitalism, historical progress in the Hegelian sense is falsified. In other words, a kind of Benjaminian dialectics at a standstill. And of course, being at a standstill also means regressing. In other words, you don't actually maintain your place. You actually regress. And this idea comes from Korsch, and it comes from Lukács. It comes from, actually, Marx's critique of the young Hegelians, which is to say that the young Hegelians have regressed below Hegel. And, of course, right Hegelians have also obviously regressed, that the affirmative approach is a regression. It's a kind of a complacency. It's an affirmation of bourgeois freedom, even after bourgeois freedom has become self-contradictory in capitalism.
Well, but doesn't this go back to the Owl of Minerva? I mean, if your idea of progress is that it comes out of an unconscious social relationship that's productive, one that isn't an idea, right? Therefore, it's unconscious, and the kind of spontaneous protests and changes and discontinuities that are going to take place within that realm of social production that isn't conscious of itself, then or that can only become conscious of itself after the fact.
Right, it's going to work itself out,
right,
and realize itself after the fact.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if you believe that, then there is no demand for conscious activity.
That's right.
So I mean that's a problem that's, I guess, in a certain reading of Hegel.
It is, right? But Hegel was not a revolutionary. In other words, Hegel was a philosopher. He did circumscribe the task of philosophy. He did not think that philosophy's task was to change the world, right? So philosophy's task was to recognize why the world had changed.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel as though this is a problem that we haven't fully worked out in Marxism either, right? I mean, obviously.
Or we could say it's there in Marxism, there's an awareness of it, but it's quickly lost sight of.
Right. So what I want to suggest is that the way to actually overcome this problem is to experiment with new forms of productive activity, with new social relationships. I know there are problems that arise in my head even as I say that, like I'm not really wanting to advocate a prefigurative politics where we can just build it inside capitalism. So it does mean total revolutionary change as a part of the experiment. It can't just be prefigurative. But then that would mean coming up with some other mediating structure, some other approach, one that you are consciously aware of. Maybe it's labor certificates, like Marx suggested.
It brings us back to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, right. So one of the things that...
Which is fine.
Yeah. One of the things that you said, I think I've heard you say, is that these sorts of ideas, like say, for instance, Pericon from Michael Albert, end up being reifications.
Let me unpack what that means. Meaning that they either are ideological in the bad sense, meaning they are kind of merely formal, or they suggest possibilities not for socialism, but for capitalism. So, you know, in other words, I see something like Pericon as very much like neoliberalism. In other words, the participatory economy, that's what neoliberalism is by contrast to Fordism. Right? So, I mean, maybe that just seems a little bit too neat, but, you know, I feel that it goes back to utopian socialism, which, by the way, Marx and Engels really esteemed they really liked the utopian socialists on condition that one recognized it as a capitalist utopianism. In other words, they didn't, you know, in terms of the panoply of different kinds of socialism in the early 19th century, they're more sympathetic to utopian socialists than they are to the Christian socialists or aristocratic socialists, for example. And in some ways, they also maintain a sympathy for the utopian socialists against the reification of labor that you find in Proudhon.
My understanding of Perricone is that it really is an attempt to democratize production, to create a situation in which the workers themselves are deciding what to produce, not for exchange. They're not producing for exchange. It's not a measure. The commodities they produce won't be a measure of labor time, but will be directly produced for use. And then the whole system of participation is what's sort of replacing the economy. And frankly, my memory of Perricone, and I haven't read it in a long time and didn't read it very well probably when I first encountered it, it's just that it's a nightmare world. Like, you know, I don't want to
be... Well, it's a Proudhonian anarchist vision of a kind of mutualism replacing the money economy, for example. Now, okay, so what is the problem with that? I mean, in some ways it's a nightmare, of course, yes, right? On the other hand,
I just have been around leftists long enough to know I don't want to sit through meetings with them, and I certainly don't want those meetings that are to be consequential.
No, obviously. So, but really, what's the problem? In other words, the problem is not the misery of meetings. In other words, the problem is not the misery of participatory democracy. The misery actually is that no workshop belongs to the workers who work there. Meaning that's regressive at the level of any workshop and any workers, actually, human beings. They belong to the larger community, to the greater society. In other words, they don't belong to themselves. Like this whole notion that like my labor belongs to me. No, it does not. In other words, you were produced by society and you belong to society. And no workshop or firm belongs to the workers who work there. It belongs to society as a whole. So a Ford plant in the United States does not belong to the workers who work there. It belongs to the people of Africa too.
Right. But I mean, in order to really go at Perricone, I guess there's two ways to try to go at Perricone, really. I think one would be more exciting, but also potentially more disastrous. And this comes up with a problem. The one is to try to enact it.
Yeah.
You know, to try to seek political power in the name of Perricone, to organize around Perricone, to really make it.
Of course, you would, according to Michael Albert and other anarchists, you would never do that. In other words, what you would do is something like the Mondragon.
Oh, it's a slow transformation of.
Yes.
Into workers.
It's local. And then, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a line of attack on Perricone. But if you did it in a way that was more totalizing, if you did it as mm-hmm. a political project, then you could test it out. And if it didn't work well, if it was a nightmare, the difficulty would be how it failed, I guess. You know, we don't want.
Well, so old Marxism, right? So let's bring it back to old Marxism. So Lenin and Trotsky, of course, but also Kautsky, the Second International, sort of, you know, regular mainstream Marxism before World War I, was not opposed to one-man management. It wasn't opposed to there being a boss in a factory. It was not opposed to that. And the reason that it wasn't opposed to that is that it didn't seek to direct productive activity at the level of the shop floor, but rather at the level of capital. In other words, the idea is that a manager of a firm is taking the dictates of capital. And so in the future, the manager of the firm should take its dictates from the dictatorship of the proletariat, meaning that workers' democracy would set policy and then the managers would follow that policy as opposed to following the dictates of profitability and capitalist investment.
The way I think of it is that, you know, productive activity is its own you know, if that's that's the whole aim of life is to be productive and creative, then some factories or some workplaces might be run like a symphony orchestra, and some of them might be run in a cooperative way, depending on what is
trying to be produced. It would depend on the rationality of the specific activity, yes.
Right. So it's not, that's not actually where the problem is. It's the, total aim of production and not the...
Yeah. So the symphony orchestra, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could organize a symphony orchestra democratically, but that says nothing about whether they're going to get the social resources to sustain their activity.
Right. And well, I mean, it's been done, you know, and they don't tend to be the orchestras that are the most popular.
Right. I mean, it's a funny thing, right? And so, like, again, administration, you know, like Castoriadis, right, had decided that, well, the real contradiction is between order givers and order takers. And it's like, yeah, not really, no. The contradiction is between capital and labor.
Yeah, I've just been reading Castoriadis and recently, like in the last 3-4 weeks, because I decided, oh, you know, I've been a big fan of Guy Debord for so long, but I never looked at socialism or barbarism or Castoriadis or any of that. And boy, it's amazing he didn't just become a right winger to me.
I mean, you could argue that he did.
Right. I mean, but like, you know, like consciously, like, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because he's really, I mean, he's a romantic figure, but he's really, I don't know. He seems religious to me, like a religious cultist.
Mm,
because it's all about what kind of people are they and... And, yeah. And
it jumps to the level of trying to transform humanity directly. And, you know, this is the problem, that has really bedeviled bourgeois society, which is to say capitalism exposes certain problems of a kind of spontaneous, organic evolution of the human community. Right. In other words, what classical bourgeois thought put its faith in, you know, the general will, if you will, working itself out. And capitalism in its crisis then seems to suggest, well, no, we need a moral, ethical universe to be established to reform human beings. You could say that Jacobinism, right, the dictatorship of virtue is a kind of regression to religion.
Yeah, it seems pretty pervasive, all these different forms of it. I mean, a lot of people talk about identity politics today, but I don't think that's the core problem at all. I think the core problem is this problem of trying to find the right kind of people or to figure out exactly who we want to be and what sort of, you know, like before there's this old idea, you know, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me kind of idea. Like, oh, I'm going to change my inner world. And that happened in a big way in the 70s after the failure of 68, everyone just retreated into workshops and things like that. So yeah, I definitely see that as a problem. And it's also a problem in the very early socialists.
Like, it is.
And like Fourier and others. But it's a problem.
It's a recurrent problem.
Yeah. And it's one you can't, but you have to have that problem even just to start to overcome it, right? I mean, it's not like...
Yes. In other words, it's a manifest issue. I mean, I guess what it comes down to for Marx and Engels is that they recognized that they recognized the rationality of bourgeois society, even in capitalism. And they saw the workers' movement for socialism necessarily transcending that kind of old-fashioned, kind of retrograde ethical community mentality. Right? In other words, they kind of had a faith in the workers' own liberalism. Right? In the sense of... you know, okay, we're going to make certain demands and, you know, we're going to make demands for democracy. We're going to make demands for, shorter work day and higher compensation, you know, we're going to make demands vis-a-vis capital. And other than that, you know, we're going to be pretty much laissez-faire, right? In other words, we're not going to make socialism into, you know, a religious movement governing the personal lives of the working class.
Yeah. Marx was not Mao.
No. Yeah, I mean, right? And so, and, you know, and the thing is with Mao, you know, kind of poor Mao in a sense, which is, what are you going to do in China? I mean, he had actual reactionaries. You know, he had like feudalistic landlords. You know, I mean, shit. You know, I mean, he had peasants who were deferential towards their landlords. You know, that's a real problem.
Right. But it's a problem that you can't overcome with becoming the landlord. You know, you can't.
No, I mean, well, obviously what Mao tried to do is he put a rifle in the peasant's hand and said, kill your landlord, or, you know, but before you kill him, make sure you tell him about the history of suffering in your family under this landlord. Right. As like a kind of like, you know, a kind of making the peasant into a subject.
Right. But he also, you know, wrote. I mean, I'm not a deep scholar on Mao, and I should read him, but he also thought that there was a kind of person who was proletariat, and that, you know, there was an ethical subject already waiting there for everybody, and what they had to do was fall in line with the program to get there, you know, to become those kinds of people.
It's unfortunate. I mean, the thing is, you could find roots for that kind of everywhere. In other words, you could find it in, like, Lenin, you know, you could say that Mao read Lenin and Lenin said, you know, the proletariat is by necessity collectivistic, you know, that they're disciplined by the factory. And so they, you know, are spontaneously anathema to any petty bourgeois individualism because they know the necessities of collective labor. Right. And it's like, well, sure, Lenin said that, but you know what I mean? But it's like, well, obviously, like, that's hardly the point.
And it's not true anymore, anyway.
Yes.
Right. I mean, even if it was true then, it's not true now. And also, collectivity is only one side of the whole socialist project.
Yes. In other words, like, Lenin had taken bourgeois individual freedom so much for granted that he didn't feel the need to advocate for it. Right. In other words, he just sort of assumed that a kind of healthy bourgeois common sense and people leaving each other alone would prevail. In other words, you know, he didn't think that the factory trained workers to get into each other's business.
Right. Well, he was wrong.
Right.
Well, but back to philosophy, I mean, the question still remains.